Well, good morning, y'all.
Good morning.
Great to be here. I pride myself on never giving the same talk twice, so I'm going to deliver an entirely different presentation than I did for those of you who were here at 9 a.m., starting with my entrance. Paula so graciously introduced me last time. I came bounding up on stage, began to speak, and she was like, "Mitch, no, not yet." So we're already off to a fresh start. The theme of my talk this morning is the miracle of a definite chief aim. And if you have trouble recollecting definite chief aim, just say DCA. You can just abbreviate it. I feel it's important to start off with a quick definition, because I would never use the term miracle in some kind of a glib or light-handed way. It's a term of deep sacredness and seriousness. But at the same time, it's not so far removed from our lives that we cannot relate to it. As I use the term miracle, it means a fortuitous departure from all expected circumstance. It's that simple. A fortuitous departure from all expected circumstance. Life is very dynamic, is filled with all kinds of events and frictions. Sometimes deep and profound setbacks befall us. And sometimes we experience just extraordinary good news and turns of events. And those of us who follow the path of unity, new thought, other metaphysical paths, usually have arrived at the conviction that there is an interplay between what goes on within us and without us. There is a very direct interplay between our thoughts and things that happen to us. And we have a yearning to explore that in its deepest spiritual sense. I have come to believe very deeply at this point in my search that thoughts are causative. We live under many laws and forces. But the very fact that our minds can be a channel of some kind of non-physical force, some higher influence, is itself extraordinary enough. There are many things going on. Now, my definite chief aim is to chronicle metaphysical experience through all kinds of different channels, including as a participant. I test these ideas within the laboratory of my own experience, as most all of you do. And I've come very deeply to the conviction that you can unleash extraordinary potentials in yourself, intellectually, spiritually, physically, if you can arrive at one deeply held, passionate wish, which serves as the basis for your entire existence. If you can be brave enough, determined enough, and at liberty enough to really ask yourself in a mature and sustained way, what is that thing that I most deeply wish for? Now, we all have lots of things that life demands of us. We play different roles in life. Family roles, professional roles, roles in our communities. We have financial needs, physical needs. So immediately people want to say, well, gee, you know, there's all kinds of things that I'm called upon to do. But I do believe that life strikes a certain bargain with us. I believe we have to avoid dispersing our energies. And I believe the bargain that life strikes with us is that we can unlock extraordinary capacities, unknown capacities within ourselves at any age, at any time, provided we're willing to meet life at its bargain and come to the conviction of a deep, passionately held ethical aim. And it can be anything. And you mustn't let anybody define it for you. And you mustn't let anybody put the weight on your shoulders that says, well, that's not spiritual enough. Well, you should be paying attention to that which we can't see. Is that so? Is that so? We live in two worlds, the transcendent and the material. It may be that your aim is a very practical aim. It may be that your aim is for recovery. It may be that your aim is for some individual career or professional or artistic accomplishment. I came to this idea about the centrality and the miraculousness of having a definite chief aim when I was researching one of my previous books, One Simple Idea, which is a history of the positive mind movement. I wanted to document the lives of people like Charles and Myrtle Fillmore, Mary Baker Eddy, Ernest Holmes, a variety of other mystical figures who I felt over the past 150 years had presented the modern world with this revolution in spirituality where we began to understand ourselves as channels of the higher. I felt their story hadn't been told, their influence hadn't been documented, and their lessons hadn't been looked back on with the proper degree of perspective. So I wrote that book. And I had this very moving experience while I was working on it, and it's what brought me to this idea. It was an experience that unfolded in the life of one of my true personal heroes, Bill Wilson, the co-founder of Alcoholics Anonymous. Bill was just an extraordinary man and a real spiritual adventurer. There was almost no place that Bill was unwilling to look for spiritual guidance and techniques and ideas if he felt it would aid in his definite chief aim, which was this, which was to remain sober and to help others do the same. That was Bill's definite chief aim. It was that simple. And these weren't two things, as he discovered, they were one. Because Bill arrived at the conviction very early in his co-founding of Alcoholics Anonymous that fellowship was a central part of recovery, that sobriety absolutely required fellowship. To stay sober, he had to help another stay sober. That was his core insight. And that unlocked Bill's definite chief aim and contributed to the founding and development of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, there was a strange episode in Bill's life. One of his co-founders of AA, a man named Ebbie Thatcher, had first exposed Bill to the idea of a spiritual approach to recovery. This was in the early 1930s. Oddly enough, later in life, Bill's wife, Lois Wilson, who was his real spiritual and intellectual partner, Lois was looking back on the lives of these two men. And she observed that Bill, he was able to fulfill his definite chief aim. He did stay sober his whole life. And at this point in time, his ideas have probably helped millions of people worldwide stay sober. But Ebbie, the man who had exposed Bill to the spiritual principles of recovery, Ebbie lapsed back into drinking. And for most of his life, he bounced in and out of recovery centers, and Bill would send him checks from time to time to help keep him going. And Lois, looking back, asked herself the question, what was the difference in the lives of these two individuals? Both were dedicated, both were good men, both really tried to live by spiritual principles, but one fell down and the other stayed sober. What was the difference? And in Lois's estimation, Ebbie wanted to stop drinking, maybe because he wanted to stay out of trouble. He knew it was bad for him. But Bill, and these were Lois's words, Bill wanted it with his whole soul. That's what unlocked Bill's power. It's not that one guy had better willpower than the other, or one had better ideas than the other, or Bill was something that Ebbie wasn't. No, no, no. Bill wanted it with his whole soul, in Lois's estimation. And the moment I came upon that simple observation, I said to myself, could that be it? Could that be the key that we're all looking for? That key that unlocks within us the potential that we all know we contain. What do you want with your whole soul? It puts us in front of a challenge because Bill didn't say, well, I want to be successful in finance. He had been a financier in his previous life. I want to have a great, you know, vacation home up at Lake George in upstate New York, and I want to stay sober. He selected one aim. He selected one beautiful, narrowly defined, but passionate and enriching channel through which to direct all of his energies. And when you do that, I really believe in my heart, I say this because I've experienced it in my own life, you summit possibilities that you never knew you had, including physical possibilities. People ask me, I raised two boys in New York with my wife, and I am doing quite a bit. And everybody says, you know, where do you find the time to write? How do you turn out these books? I think it was Reverend Paula was just saying to me before, I just entered a contract for a series of 10 books. She said, are you really going to write 10 books? And it's like, yes, I just finished the second one. I'm a little hyper, you know, admittedly. But there are times, quite frankly, where I want to write more than I want to sleep. I want to write more than I want to eat. And it just comes pouring out of me. Now, we have physical limitations, and there are times where the individual has to take a break. And it's time to just kick back and watch an episode of Star Trek or whatever it may be. But I never thought I would discover that level of energy within me. And it was the narrowness, the passionate quality, and the selectivity of having one definite chief aim, which, again, for me, was to chronicle metaphysical experience, including as a seeker. It must be, in fact, very simple and can go in any direction. Any direction. I really want to make that very clear to you. No one can define for you what your definite aim should be, what your passion should be. And I feel very strongly that I don't want anybody to be embarrassed about having the wrong aim or an aim that doesn't seem spiritually developed or what have you. It's funny, I wrote a piece recently in Science of Mind. Some of you may have seen it, in defense of the movie The Secret. I got tired of this backlash that was brewing against The Secret. Every time I would run into somebody, they would stop to reassure me, well, I don't go in for that stuff like The Secret, you know? And I had so many people saying this to me, you would think that nobody ever liked that movie at all. You know, millions of people downloaded it and bought the book. But I couldn't find one person who would commit him or herself to saying, I liked The Secret. So I started to get suspicious of this. It started to sound to me a little bit like a herd mentality. It was almost as if, like, in order to represent that you were serious, you had to start every conversation by dumping on The Secret. And I'm thinking, it's 10 years old now. I think we can move on. But I decided as an experiment to rewatch the movie with one of my younger kids, Toby, who at the time was 10 years old, is now 11. And I have to disclose this to you. I loved it. I thought the values were terrific. And he was engaged by it and enjoyed it. And, you know, everybody says that thing about, I don't like The Secret because the end of all spiritual searching shouldn't be the manifestation of a Mercedes-Benz. It's not in there. There's no Mercedes-Benz in there. I think, what movie are they watching? However, I must say this, and I made this point in my Science of Mind article, if there were a Mercedes-Benz in there, which there isn't, if there were, I would defend that person. I would defend that person. Because who am I to say what's of value and what fulfills a need in the life of an individual? It could be that a means of transportation, a means of solid, dependable transportation, is absolutely necessary in the life of an individual. Maybe that person's going to use that car to drive around to places that make a positive difference in the lives of a whole network of people that the person judging him or her knows nothing about? I don't know. But I do believe that if your aim is ethical and nonviolent, it is right. And when I say nonviolent, I mean something that doesn't violate emotionally or physically another person's ability to reach his or her highest aspiration. That's all. I don't like to see people twist themselves into knots over whether their aim is ethical. I believe we are ethical beings, and if you're on a spiritual path, and if you're dedicated not to violating another's rights or another community's rights to pursue his or its own highest development, then you are on ethically solid ground, and you should pursue that which most speaks to your heart, that which most makes you a channel of the higher, of the good, of reality. I have a friend in New York City, a dear, dear friend of mine, who spent many years working in the publishing business, along with me. And he was very unhappy. He felt completely directionless. And one day, he and I went out to lunch, and we were sitting in a pizza parlor, and he said to me, in this very determined way, "Here's what I need." And I thought he was going to say, you know, "I need the oregano," or "I need a salt," or something, because he was just said it immediately, and I'm getting ready to reach for something. He goes, "I need a definite purpose in life." And I tried to talk him into the fact that in publishing he was doing all kinds of good things, but he didn't buy it. He felt like he wasn't making a difference in the public sphere, and he wanted that more than anything. And he thought about it and thought about it, and at age 40, he wound up going back to law school, working very hard, maintaining a job, studying for a law degree, raising his family. He got his law degree, and he got a job as a prosecutor in the Manhattan DA's office. And he was older than a number of other people in the office. Most of the other prosecutors, obviously, they had gone to law school at the traditional time. They were much younger. But his age was actually a uniquely helpful factor, because most of the kids in the Manhattan DA's office, and a lot of them were kids, I mean, these are prosecutors who are age, you know, 24, 25, they wanted to build their reputations on a kind of get tough approach. Everybody thinks, you know, get tough, and that'll show people that you're serious and you're capable and you're doing the right thing. And having the perspective of being in his early 40s, my friend understood what going to prison, for example, does to the life of an individual. And he could say, "Well, wait a minute. You know, we're not here to get tough. We're here to intelligently and maturely enforce the law, but not to build our reputations on the backs of somebody else." And he eventually was able to parlay that into the job he occupies right now, where he is a special prosecutor who works for the Attorney General of the state of New York, and he investigates the police shootings of unarmed civilians. And he is making the difference that he wanted to make in the public sphere. It's not about going in one political direction or another. It's about asking yourself, what am I most passionately dedicated to which I'm willing to make the foundation of my entire existence? And when you reach that point of a deeply felt, passionately felt aim, again, you will find that all kinds of barriers start to ease. All kinds of things come to meet you. I know it because I've experimented with it in my own life, and I've observed it both historically in the life of figures like Bill Wilson, and there are many others I could mention, and in the lives of people who are close to me, write to me, work with me, search with me. And I will guarantee you this. I will guarantee you this, and I have to be very careful to be clear about this. An aim, by its definition, must be narrow and well-focused. I don't use the term narrow in some kind of a negative way. A channel is narrow. It focuses energy in that way. Dams are built through relatively narrow openings so that the hydro energy builds up behind them. You mustn't disperse your energies and capacities. And if you look at the lives of individuals who are heroes to you, whether in history or contemporary figures, people that you know in your lives, in your neighborhood, or figures that you don't know but whose lives you admire, you will almost always find that the qualities that make these people heroes to you are one very narrowly defined purpose. As I was saying this morning, Nelson Mandela didn't just say to himself, I'd like to set all of humanity free. That was, of course, his principle. But his definite aim was to set South Africa free. Harriet Tubman didn't say, I want all people to be free from slavery. Of course, that's what she wanted. But where she stood, she needed to free African people from enslavement and bring them to the North or to Canada. That was her definite chief aim. Helen Keller had as her definite chief aim demonstrating in her own abilities, her own personal capacity, that somebody with handicaps was capable of so much more than what the world at that time was willing to concede. And on and on and on. Of course, I could extend this example to soldiers, to diplomats, to artists, to business people, to scholars. Nobody says, Bill Gates, there's a great tennis player. You know, that's not what you think of him for, although he may be, you know. He was a great entrepreneur and programmer. If you look at the lives of people you want to emulate and people you admire, you will almost always find that they were willing to stake their existence on one narrowly, yes, narrowly defined, chief definite aim. And it made them into a channel for everything that was great within them and great without them. It was an act of great fulfillment. And my deepest wish for everyone in this room is that you dedicate this day, and maybe many other days to follow, on the mature, considered, private reflection of what your chief aim is. And I think we'll do a meditation to that effect now. Thank you. Let's close our eyes for a moment, please. On this day, as the sun is breaking through the clouds outside, ask yourself, what is it that I wish will break through in me? What practical, mature, and passionate capacity or work is striving to be done through me? This is an exercise that is exquisitely intimate to you. No one can dictate to you what your particular unique aim is, and no one can take it from you. You are a channel for the highest there is. And the expression of that highest can take so many different forms. The key to unlocking that expression is the focus of your energies. What is that special individual focus that will make you a channel for the highest that there is? Dedicate this one day to releasing all preconceptions, all ideas of what can and can't be done, all buts or ends or what ifs. Suspend that all for one day. One day. And in that space, dwell upon what practical, focused, passionate aim is yours in this world. That will bring to you extraordinary energies and abilities. It's there waiting to traverse through you. Let us all reflect this day together and individually on what the unique, sacred nature of your aim is.
Flow.